Good later morning. It's my pleasure to introduce Rabbi David Horowitz. He is Rabbi Emeritus of Temple Israel in Akron, where he served for 18 years. He is also the past national president of PFLAG, which stands for Parents, Family, Friends of Lesbians and Gays. So, Rabbi Horowitz.
Show of hands, how many people were here in 2005 when I was here? Oh, I'm sorry. Another show of hands. How many people are here from churches at which I have spoken to in the last couple of years? Folks, look around. These are the true masochists. I'd like to begin by probably insulting everybody in the room. Because I'd like to start with a song, some music. For half of you, the words will be insulting. For the other half, my singing will be insulting. And so we'll go with the whole works right off the bat. The words I've written up here, they're just two words, Hodu Ladonai. Hodu Ladonai, the Hebrew of give thanks to God. Half gone, my singing coming. So say it, Hodu Ladonai. Okay, listen to it once and then jump right in because this is painful. Hodu Ladonai, Hodu Ladonai, Hodu Ladonai, Hodu Ladonai. Hodu Ladonai, you can do this, you use Hodu Ladonai, Hodu Ladonai, Hodu Ladonai, Hodu Ladonai, Hodu Ladonai. Very nice. Your music, incidentally, worship and music this morning was absolutely beautiful. I mean, our music sucks, so this is really a treat for me. Again, those of you who were in 2005 to quote Yogi Berra, the late Yogi Berra, this must seem like deja vu all over again. I got to tell you, I was really, really honored when Alan called and asked if I could be here again for your Summer Institute. I had a ball last time I was here. And then I realized I was a last-minute replacement, and I had this picture of him sitting around saying, oh, God, who doesn't work? who can we possibly get? And, hi, folks! I'm going to take my watch off to give you hope. That's all it really does. Trust me. Actually, you're in good shape this morning because I had two cups of coffee and forgot to go to the bathroom before I started now. So you have absolutely nothing to worry about. Let me start by saying that the title, The Journey of Change, was really my second choice. My first choice was to use the title The Theology of Change. But then I remembered a lesson I learned in 2005. The tremendous diversity that exists within the UU Church and churches and community, that song, Welcome Whoever You Are, Welcome for Wherever You Come From, really does, I think, personify the reality of the UU Church. And I remember, it was at a talkback session in 2005, and somebody sneezed. And I looked around and just kind of reflexively said, God bless you, if that's not offensive. You never know who you're going to get in trouble with, around here. So if somebody sneezes this year, I'm going to use the Hebrew labriut, which means to health. And I think that's fair, that's safe, and we'll go from there. But this is an incredibly diverse group of people, and I will probably not help that in any way whatsoever. The theme of the week is change. Some things change, some things never change. In 2005, my talkback session was over against beer. And in 2014, it is over against beer. Hey! Beer, Horowitz, beer, Horowitz. Without recognizing the diversity, I can know where this is going to go. It doesn't take a lot. As you have been reminded over and over again, this is a time of great change for the Summer Institute. You're in a new place. You're with a theme speaker that you didn't expect to have when some of you signed up. And hence, this is also a change for you. I'm kind of reminded a little bit of what's going on in our synagogue in Akron. We're in the process of building a new building. Now, the building we're leaving is a 1910 structure that the congregation built. And so there are 3 to 4 generations of people who have come up through that congregation, been educated there, who have worshiped in that building. And the way I look at it is there are basically 4, this is an oversimplification, but probably 4 groups of people. There are some people in our congregation who grew up in that building, who knew nothing but that building, whose children grew up in the building. For them, nothing will take the place of that building. Nothing you can say or do will make them happy. I mean, they walk around disgruntled. They talk around. They mumble all the time about how good it was in the old. Now, they haven't left it yet, but they're already talking about how good it was in the old days, despite the fact that the old building's leaking everywhere and the pipes are bursting, but that doesn't make any difference. That's their building, and nothing will change their mind. And so that's one group. Then there's a group that was involved in finding the new location and the building that has actually been almost torn down and is being rebuilt as a new synagogue. They love that place. They love that location. There is nothing in the world that will make them change their mind that that is the only location in the entire area of Akron, in spite of the fact that it's in a commercial area, in spite of the fact that there's lots of traffic, in spite of the fact that there's an Acme supermarket on this side, there's a Barnes & Noble store on that side, and they're surrounded by this activity. Nothing will change their mind. They love it, and that's group two. Then there's a third group. The third group doesn't mind moving. They're not crazy about where the new location is, but they would not mind moving. That would be okay. They just are not happy as to where it's going to be. That's group three. Then there's the fourth group. I don't know if they're a majority, or I don't know if they're a large plurality, but they're one or the other. That group really doesn't give a damn. Basically, that group figures, as long as it's the place I'm not going to go to anyhow, I may as well not go there as well as not go here. It doesn't matter. Now, I haven't had enough time here yet to know if all 4 of those groups exist within this body. But I suspect that in one form or another, they exist. Those who are so attached to Kenyon College, despite the fact that the only place I could get phone reception at Kenyon College was 7 steps away from the inn and up about the 3rd or 4th level of the stadium. Nowhere else in Kenyon College could I talk to anybody by phone. In spite of that, nonetheless, there are those I'm sure who feel that way, and I respect that. And I have some feelings for that old building as well in Akron, and I'm kind of in mourning, although I probably go with the last group. Some of you love being here. It's a beautiful campus. It does have phone reception everywhere. Most places. It is wired. It's a beautiful location. The town is very, very lovely, both blocks of it. So that's the place. For some of you, change is okay. Change is okay. But maybe not here. Maybe you wanted Hiram or some other location I know that was in the running. And for some of you, as long as you're not going to be at these sessions anyhow, what difference does it make? So, it's We're here for the beer. I understand that. My next thought when I was planning this presentation was, there is nothing new under the sun and change is inevitable. Now, how am I going to cram that into 5 days? That was the big challenge. And I'm going to do that by helping you sleep. It's early in the morning, and realizing that that's probably... I used to say that there were only really three sermons that a rabbi had, period. Only three sermons ever. There was God, there was Torah, and there was Israel. Everything else is a reworking of one of those three. And my son, every high holidays, would sit down at dinner and say, "So what's it going to be, Dad, tonight? God, Torah, Israel, you know?" And I tell him, he's, "I don't have to go now." So, you know, it's the same kind of thing. I'm not sure there's any new messages in this or anything you haven't heard before, but nonetheless, they're paying me a fair amount of money to be here, so I will, and I'll bore you with my thoughts. My second thought went to the prophet Kohelet in the book of Ecclesiastes. The prophet Kohelet talks, first of all, of the futility of the thought of permanence. Nothing is permanent. In fact, Kohelet, the prophet in Ecclesiastes, is really a very cynical person. He really has a great deal believing in anything. He wonders why anything is considered to be important, because there is nothing new, and some are going to be miserable, and some are going to be happy. In fact, that's the phrase, there's nothing new under the sun. And so I'm going to quote a little bit from Ecclesiastes. This is, incidentally, the Bible I picked up here. I have the same version in my room. It's the New Revised Standard Version. Now, I've got to tell you, I use this because I do another program for a Methodist group, and that's the official Bible of that group. And so when they told me that, and I think it was 2004 when I started with them, I had to go out and buy a copy. Rabbis don't buy copies of Bibles with New Testaments. Okay, we don't do that. We go up to somebody on a street corner and we say, "I'm Jewish." They slap one of those Bibles in your hand just like that. It is incredible. It is a phenomenon that I've never really fully understood. It's just incredible. Alas, they're always the King James Version of the Bible. I've got a dozen of those. I mean, you know, they're all over the place, including the hotel rooms. And so I had to buy this, and my hand was shaking as I signed the charge slip. But I got through it, and I've gotten used to realizing that I own it already, although I bitch about it at every program I do for them. They offered to pay me back, but it's not worth it. So I quote from Kohelet in Ecclesiastes. "For everything there is a season, and a time for every matter under the sun, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to throw away stones, and a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to keep and a time to throw away, a time to tear and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. For everything, there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven." Life is a repetitive process. Life begins, it matures, it ends. I must tell you that the bad news I'm going to give you now is that 100% of the people who belong to UU churches die. It is a very high statistic. Since I spend a lot of time in UU churches these days, it's not one I'm fond of. In fact, I spend so much time there that my congregation thinks you've ordained me. And that wouldn't be a bad thing, okay? I mean, if anybody wants to do that, let me know. But maybe it's time already. But in this repetitive nature of birth to death, and even a repetitive nature that we find in history, there is, in fact, a sacred journey, a journey on which we all walk. And one of my colleagues, Alvin Fine, who wrote this, probably in the 1980s. He passed away in 1999. And he wrote, "Birth is a beginning and death a destination. But life is a journey, a going, a growing from stage to stage, from childhood to maturity, from youth to age, from innocence to awareness, and ignorance to knowing, from foolishness to discretion, and then perhaps to wisdom, from weakness to strength, or strength to weakness, and often back again, from health to sickness, and back we pray to health again, from offense to forgiveness, from loneliness to love, from joy to gratitude, from pain to compassion, and grief to understanding, from fear to faith, from defeat to defeat to defeat, until looking backward or ahead, we see that victory lies not at some high place along the way, but in having made the journey, stage by stage, a sacred pilgrimage. Birth is a beginning and death a destination. But life is a journey, a sacred pilgrimage made stage by stage from birth to death to life everlasting." I love that reading. I love it for a number of reasons. First of all, on a theological level, and this will get me in trouble at the talk back, I'll handle it. On a theological level, I truly believe that there is nothing in this universe that is not permanent. Everything lives on forever. The fact that we are will always have been. I know I did this at some of your churches, and maybe in 2005, but I want to demonstrate that for a moment. I'm going to throw my keys in the air. Sorry, I've got some kind of a frog. I'm going to throw my keys in the air. I'm going to tell them to stay. If they do, we're going to talk about miracles. Just saying. My guess would be that they will not stay and that they'll hit the ground. Stay. Not a hard trick. Anybody wants to learn that later, I can do that. So what can I say about that? I can say that just about at 9:50 in the morning on the 14th day of July, it's the 14th day of July in 2014, I threw my keys in the air and they hit the ground. No matter what happens to the end of time, that is now a permanent part of history. We could go out and get hit by a bicycle that some kid is not watching while he's riding. But the fact that I threw my keys in the air is a permanent part of history. Nothing will ever change that. No happening, no event, no moment, no recognition is going to make that different. It is all a part of history. And so we were born, and so we will die. There is no such thing as a life lost, for it is part of history. There is no such thing as a life that has not affected the universe as a whole, not just the people around, but everything in the universe is affected by every single human being who comes into this earth No matter what, no matter what your theology, no matter what your belief, every person has changed the universe. And that's permanent. That will never be reversed. And yet that is continuous. So the next person born is also going to change the universe. And the one after that, and the one after that, and the acts that we do during our lifetime, every one of those acts are permanent. Every one of those acts will never change, and yet the next act will change everything. It will never be the same. And so it is even in our death. You know, in Jewish tradition, it is not customary to recognize birthdays of famous people. I mean, Washington's birthday, Lincoln's birthday, which is now President's Day. We don't do that. Instead, we remember what we call the Yahrzeit. We remember the anniversary of death. And every year in the synagogue, people's names are read who died during that week or that day, depending on whether it's daily worship or weekly worship. And sometimes we are an old congregation. Sometimes it sounds like that week was the week of the plague when they're being read, you know. But we do that, and we do that because when somebody is born, we know nothing about what that life is going to be. Nothing about what that life is going to produce. Nothing about anything around that individual except, God willing, it's healthy. Secondarily, it's a girl. I always wanted girls. Can always tell the difference in a birth when somebody called me and would say, my wife just gave birth to a son, or my wife just gave birth to a baby. You knew, right? Okay, you know. I always wanted girls. Nothing. But at death, we know. At death, we have that history. At death, we know who that person touched. What difference did that person make? And there's nobody without difference. What accomplishment. What glory. What misery. What tribulation. What overcoming tribulation. That's the journey I'm hoping we can talk about during this five-day period. That sacred journey of change and change and change, and yet everything being a permanent part of a universe that is both ever-changing and the same. It's ever-expanding and the same. It's ever-present and it's ever-different. Think about that. Think about how incredible that is. How two seemingly different kinds of thoughts can come together and be at one in a sea in which we travel as human beings. You know, in Jewish tradition, and that's what I'm going to talk out of. I mean, that's all I really know, and I make that up. I always told people in the congregation, you can ask me any question you want. If I don't know the answer, I'll make it up. But I'll make it up convincingly, okay? You'll never know I just made it up. The paradigm of that change is truly the paradigm that comes out of the story of the Exodus from Egypt. For in that story of the Exodus is all of that permanence and change simultaneously. In the Exodus, we find that when the children of Israel crossed the Sea of Reeds, the Red Sea, whatever sea that was, there was joy, there was ecstatic dancing. Miriam led the women in dancing around. They were singing hymns of praise. And there's a midrash. A midrash is a parable. A midrash is a story that's told by the rabbis. It's not true. It's a myth. Okay? Now, I know myth has a bad reputation. For some people, myth is somebody else's religion we don't believe. That's myth. I'm going to suggest to you that the best definition I heard of myth and then midrash is that myth is a story that is not true that teaches truth. I love that definition. which may be the whole scripture, but that's another time for another topic. Not going to go there. Well, maybe I will, but not today. The Midrash says that when the children of Israel crossed the Sea of Reeds and got to the other side, God's angels were singing joy and happiness over the redemption. And God said to the angels, "Why are you singing?" And the angels said, "Because your children, Israel, are free." And God said, "Don't sing, cry. My children, the Egyptians, are drowning." Apply that to this moment. Apply that to all moments. And so there was joy, there was celebration. We're free. We're free at last. But you know, freedom is not so easy. And many times the children of Israel would turn to Moses. I don't know how you picture Moses. I really don't know. For most of us, well, for most of us who are older, it's Charlton Heston. Standing with arms outstretched and parting a sea. I have a little bit different picture of Moses. I picture him as a small man, probably balding, actually probably Ben Kingsley in Gandhi, you know, kind of bent over a little bit. And incidentally, did you all see Gandhi? I had that feeling at one point that if he took one more darn step in the desert, I was going to shoot him myself. Come on, let's get this going already. But that's Moses, right? Moses is in that desert. And what does he hear? "Moses, we were better off as slaves. At least there we had 3 square meals a day. Here we have no food." Well, okay, Moses, head in hand. "Oy gavay, these people are driving me crazy." Goes to God and he says to God, hey, the people are hungry. And God says, okay, I'm going to bring manna. Manna, every day there's going to be manna. Now you think that would be great. And it was for a while. But then the people come to Moses and say, "Moses, we're sick and tired of manna. I mean, how many times a day can we eat manna? At least back in Egypt we had meat to eat and fish and all sorts of wonderful different things to eat back in Egypt. I want to go back to Egypt. I want to go back to Kenyan too, but I want to go back to Egypt." And so Moses goes, "Oy gavay." So Moses goes to God, and Moses says to God, "God, the manna is a nice thing, but the people are sick of it. They want meat." So God gets angry at that point, and God says to Moses, "You know something? I'm going to bring pheasants. They're going to have meat, and they're going to eat that meat until it comes out of their noses." And that's a direct quotation from the Bible. Going to eat. It is. I'm not even making that up. I make other things up, but that's there. I love that phrase. They're going to eat until it comes out of their noses. And so the children of Israel, you would think, would now be satisfied. Nah. Stiff-necked people. Now we're in danger. We're schlepping around. All that from a people who was singing before and now realize that the change is real. And even though they were miserable before, the change now is a challenge to them. So they murmur. So they kvetch a lot. And then something happens not long after that part that really sets a tone. You see, they're wandering around for a little bit, not very long, and they get to a place called Mount Sinai. And there at Mount Sinai, they make camp, and Moses, who's already holding his head anyhow, goes up on a mountain. And at the top of that mountain, Moses receives a message from God. With thunder and with lightning, all of a sudden, God gives 10 basic rules. Now, I don't like the words commandments here. I really don't like them. There is a Hebrew word for commandment. It's mitzvah. When you do a mitzvah, you're not doing just a good deed. You're doing something God requires of you, and that's what's good about it. So when you visit the sick, that's not a good deed. God requires you to visit the sick. You're doing a mitzvah. That's a commandment. These are not called mitzvot. These are not called commandments in the biblical text. In the Hebrew, it says devarim, and God spoke these words, saying words. Suggestions, maybe, but words. And so there was that moment where there was a group of commandments that are given to the children of Israel by God at Sinai. The 10 that are there in Jewish tradition are 10 out of 613. Okay? We got more. The only thing that's very lucky is that there's never been one authoritative list. There are numerous lists, and they don't agree. So we can ignore all the lists saying it's not on that one. I mean, you know, it's... But those are the ones that are most talked about. You know, only the single God. Well, we probably haven't got room for many more than that anyhow. You shall have no other gods before me. I'm going to come back to that phrase later this week, because that's an important phrase. That's not as simple as it seems on the surface. You shall not steal, not kill, no adultery, no idolatry. All these kinds of things are there that we basically ignore. Well, actually, we don't ignore all of them. It's just the one that says, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. That one we've killed. Okay, that one's not there. That one's a shopping day now. And I think we've made a great mistake, but hey, that's me. And so they got these commandments. They got these mitzvot and the words. Maybe not the same thing. And now their freedom is no longer free. They have been changed. They can't do anything that they want. They've got to conform to what God wants. Wow. Wow. Think about that for a second. You just left slavery and now you're going back to rules and regulations and things you've got to follow. Not a pleasant thought into the future, but it's there. It's what God is making you do. And what is beginning to happen is a society is being formed out of a group that's ragtag. You know, it's not just Israelites that go out of Egypt. The text says that there were Israelites, there were Habiru, there were Egyptians. There were all sorts of people that went out of Egypt with the Israelites. They were really kind of brought together by a commonness of actually, in those days, a single God concept, but not the only God, a single God for them concept. But they weren't a cohesive body. And so now we've got rules. And still, they've got to wander. 40 years they schlep around. 40 years they find orange juice. 40 years they miss the oil. Do you know the history of the world would be different today if they had found that damn oil? Until finally an entire generation had to change. An entire generation had to cease to be and a new one come into being, because then the change made by the older generation is permanent. Okay, that's not going to go away. But now the new generation is able to incorporate this into a society, into a culture, into a being of people. And so they have moved from slavery to freedom. And even then, this nomadic tribe enters a land. And they're no longer nomadic. Now they plant crops. Now they have things that they have to do. Now they are into agriculture. Now they are getting established. Now they have a monarchy. They desire a monarchy. They want a monarchy. David becomes the first king over Israel. Some reason they want that. I must tell you that the scripture tells us that God was not happy with that decision and basically said to them, you're going to be sorry. But nonetheless, we want a king. Everybody else around us has a king. We want a king too. Give us a king, for crying out loud. And so David comes along, and David becomes the king of Israel, and that's a big change. Okay, that's a big, big change in the society. But you know, God is living in a tent. King lives in a palace, God in a tent. Not nice. Not a nice thing to do to God. And so they build a temple. And now they've got a temple, a place that they can focus upon in this new agricultural society. The temple, I'm not going to say that. A lot of us have had the fortune to visit different castles in Europe and palaces. And you know that there are two sections of the palace. There's the public areas, which you pay a lot to tour. And then there are the private quarters of the monarch, the inner sanctum, if you will, where they actually live, the apartments where things happen every day. Well, that was true of the temple in Jerusalem as well. There was the outer courtyard and the outer part of the temple. And then inside was the Devir, the Holy of Holies, God's house. And God dwelt there. You brought gifts to God, but God dwelt there. All that's very different from that nomadic tribe that, yes, sacrificed. But at a temple? Who needs a temple? All you need is a place to set up an altar. But now there's a temple. Now is no longer nomadic, but it's now a matter of settling into the land. And this new generation of the children of Israel, who never knew slavery, who never remembered being slaves, now are told over and over again the story, because that's the permanence. That's the ongoing thread that holds everything together. And so, there is nothing new under the sun. Life's a journey. I truly believe that life's a journey. I don't think it's an easy journey. I think we go kicking and screaming along the way. I think we don't like change. I don't like change. I like everything the way it was. I don't adjust to change well, although I did adjust to retirement well. No negatives to that. It's funny, when I'm in the synagogue and I found myself doing the same thing here when I came into worship last night and this morning. In the synagogue, I sit in the last seat in the last row. And when I started doing that, somebody walked by and said, Rabbi, why are you sitting all the way back here? And I just looked at them and said, because I can. But then I tried to figure out why I did that, because I'm really uncomfortable sitting on the other side, no matter where. The other side just really, in fact, one high holidays, I got there later than I should have, and somebody took my seat. It really angers me a lot when somebody takes my seat. They should know better than to take my seat, you know. I made a donation to the new building fund with the understanding that my seat would always be there. Right? That doesn't change. Right? That's permanent. So, I had to sit on the other side. And it was like the whole universe was askew. I mean, it was just something I couldn't handle. So the next morning I got there a lot earlier and got my seat, and I was fine after that. But I did try to figure out why I resisted that. And I think the reason was that for all of those years, for 40-some years, I saw the entire congregation because I was in front of them. And I could see the entire room and the entire gestalt of the room and the feeling of the room. And I don't want to sit in a place where I can only see me or an ark. I want to see the people. I want to see the community of faith around me. I want to be enveloped in it. So that's a change I haven't yet made. But walk the journey this week with me. Take it step by step. Enjoy the manna. When you get sick of the manna, enjoy the meat. If you get sick of the meat, go back to manna. I was really delighted. The program I do that I mentioned before on somewhat regular basis is almost always at Catholic retreat houses. As I said, they don't have beer tasting. You know, the Methodists for their communion use grape juice. I didn't know why, so I finally asked. I mean, did Jesus really turn water into grape juice? I mean, come on, it's, you know. And so I learned. Did you know that Welsh was a Methodist? Change! Wow! So it's different. But it's also a sacred journey. So take the steps with me. You've been long-suffering and slow to anger. I truly appreciate the opportunity to be here at Summer Institute. I had a ball in 2005. I'm already having fun now. I'm having fun because as I sat at the worship last night and this morning, I was gripped by it. It spoke to me. Hopefully, parts of it will speak to parts of you every time you come together. Life is a journey, a sacred pilgrimage made step by step. And so with that, I'm going to end this morning's session and wish you well. But I want to teach you one little ditty, which you can use next time next time Alan gets announcements. Ready? Announcements, announcements, announcements. A hell of a way to die, a hell of a way to die, a hell of a way to spend the day, a hell of a way to die. Announcements, announcements, announcements. I lost my cow, I lost my cow. I have no use for your bull now, for your bull now. L'chulu shalom. Good peace.